Late Andrew Greeley was a Roman Catholic priest, a best-selling novelist, a popular columnist, and a well-known and respected sociologist of religion. Have any of you read any of Greeley's books? Okay, a few. His breakthrough bestseller was, and he remember he's a Roman Catholic priest, The Cardinal Sins, 1981. In the words of one review, Greeley did for the Catholic Church what the Godfather did for the Mafia. Now, depending on your perspective, you can decide whether that's a good thing or a not, or exactly what, I think that probably means a few different things. My favorite of Greeley's books is The Catholic Imagination, in which he explores the different ways that Catholicism and Protestantism shape the religious imaginations of those who are raised in the Christian tradition. Many Protestants grow up worshiping in brightly lit sanctuaries with stark, blank, white walls. In contrast, many Catholics grow up in more dimly lit, dark-walled, richly ornate sanctuaries filled with art. Greeley writes that Catholics live in an enchanted world, a world of statues and holy water, stained glass and votive candles, saints and religious medals, rosary beads and holy pictures. Think of it as simple as every Protestant church that you walk into has a blank cross, right? And every Catholic church has somewhere on a spectrum of Jesus hanging on a cross and increasingly detailed depending on where you are. And among the many important implications are that the Catholic imagination is one of the reasons that Greeley believes that the Catholic Church over the centuries has been a great patron of the arts, because they recognized how important the arts were. It grasps the power of imagery to convey what precise doctrinal formulas cannot. In contrast, a significant part of the Protestant Reformation that shaped the Protestant religious imagination was a rebellion against rituals, customs, and traditions that became viewed as meaningless, either as tradition for tradition's sake alone, or that religious hierarchies had come to abuse and manipulate these rituals to control or extort the laity. The stripping away of meaningless or manipulative rituals led to those stark, blank, white walls of Protestant worship spaces and the simplified liturgies of Protestant worship services that are much more literal and much more text-based than most Catholic masses. Reflecting on how the communities we have been a part of inevitably shape our respective religious imaginations can help us become more aware of the ways that what we experience during our childhood can unconsciously become our normative reference point, the standard against which all deviations are judged, even to the extent that we can sometimes find ourselves unreflectively thinking or engaging with others who are unreflectively thinking that it's always been that way. Since the beginning, people have just always done the religious ritual that way, or always used these words, or thought of it in this way. I witnessed this phenomenon most frequently during the 7 years I spent as a youth minister, especially in regard to a youth camp that I helped plan for many years in conjunction with some other congregations. Each year, there'd be some change, big or small, to the camp schedule or format, which would inevitably trigger some group or individual to protest. But we've never done it that way before. We've always done it the other way. And if you've only been attending an annual event for 3 years and something changes in year four, then that claim that it's always been that way, it seems true from your perspective. But from a more long-term perspective, those who had been attending the camp much longer knew that, in fact, almost nothing about that camp hadn't changed multiple times in the 2 decades-plus history. At the same time, I can appreciate that underneath that protest of we've always done it that way is a genuine longing for tradition, for meaning, for ritual that can only be experienced through repetition over time. And during the 8 years I served on that camp's planning team, nothing evoked more howls of protest than the periodic proposal of perhaps changing the camp's location. And I've spent a significant amount of my time at various camps and retreat centers, especially in Western North Carolina. And I can say with certainty that that camp in question in Laurel Ridge, North Carolina, that this group had been renting for each year since the year 2000, despite one breathtaking outlook way up on top of the mountain that you hardly ever saw, that camp was really nothing special. I could list 10 immensely more beautiful retreat locations in Western North Carolina without even trying hard. But those grounds, however humble, and they were humble, had become sacred to these young people through the transformative experiences they had had there. And although the camp had now met there for more than a decade, that same camp met at a different location for almost all of the 1990s, and that seaside retreat location was equally sacred ground for those young people who kicked up their heels in protest when we moved to the mountain location. And those young people couldn't imagine changing, and there had been two previous settings before the seaside location. My point is that there is power in repetition and in ritual. Even the most humble setting or rite can become sacred and hallowed time and space because as it becomes imbued with a depth and thickness of time and tradition and experience. At the same time, an overemphasis on tradition can sometimes prevent us from seeing that new rituals and traditions can become equally meaningful or potentially even more meaningful. As Unitarian Universalists, our tradition emerged from what is known as the Radical Reformation, the left wing of the 16th century Protestant Reformation. So if you look around our sanctuary this morning, you'll see, or even in our chapel, which is even more blank, you'll see the ways that we are shaped by the Protestant imagination. Our spare, clean, plain, white walls testify to that. But our large open windows looking out onto the world, they testify to the ways that the nature mysticism of our 19th century transcendentalist forebears also continues to influence us. And one of our growing edges as Unitarian Universalists is reclaiming the ways that some rituals can become deeply meaningful and transformative, engaging not just our minds, which is what we're best at often, but also our bodies through our five senses, taste, touch, sound, smell, and sight. As one of my mentors taught me, at its best, worship should be a symphony for the senses. At their best, rituals invite us into what is known as a liminal or a threshold space, a time and space in which we become more open than we might otherwise be to that sacred depth dimension of life, experiencing eternity in any present moment if we're fully present to it. And the search for moving, meaningful rituals that engages our bodies, not just our minds, is one of the reasons that during joys and sorrows, we invite you not only to share verbally, but also to drop a stone into the water, or during the other half of the year to light a candle. The realization that the Protestant imagination has overcompensated in demanding that sanctuaries always have plain white walls, lest we be idolatrous, right? That was some of what that came out of. We're less worried about that as Unitarian Universalists. But that overcompensation of the Protestant imagination is one of the reasons that we commissioned this artwork on our walls behind the pulpit, and why we are so fortunate to have regular monthly shows rotating through our Blanche Ames Art Gallery and our religious education wing. It's one reason I think that yoga is popular, that it's this embodied way of being more in getting into our bodies. And as you know, or you will find out if you stick around here regularly for a full year, we UUs increasingly have our rituals. They're fairly new, but they've become fairly widespread. We have our fall water communion, our winter fire communion, our spring flower communion, and these are found in not all, but almost all of the 1,000-plus UU congregations in this country. We have child dedication rituals, Christmas Eve candlelight services. You know, UUs love their Christmas Eve, for better or worse, and more. Actually, I think it's great, actually, though. Sometimes we sing things we don't believe in, but that's okay. It's aesthetically beautiful. The music minister at the congregation where I served in Louisiana, he used to say, if the music is beautiful, that's what I believe in. So, but even this chalice lighting that we do, how many of you ever visited a few decades ago a UU congregation in which there was not a chalice lighting? Does anybody remember that? Go back. So, I mean, this is pretty new, but now it's everywhere. So, and it's almost hard to imagine a Unitarian Universalist service that doesn't have the chalice as its symbol and doesn't light a chalice and then extinguish it. But that's pretty new, but also another symbol of introducing ritual into our communal lives together. So as I've been reflecting on UU rituals this past week, it seems to me that an occasion such as Easter Sunday could be important to also offer some form of bread communion, as you'll see, especially in some of our historic Unitarian congregations and Universalist congregations, perhaps with everyone invited to bring a loaf of their favorite bread, and that would come out of our Unitarian Universalist liberal Christian heritage, offered to those who would find it meaningful to participate. But of course, such a communion ritual in a UU setting would not be about Jesus' body and blood, which both myself and many scholars would argue that's a later development that had nothing to do with Jesus' original intention. Instead, it would be about remembering the radical way that the historical Jesus sought to build community, and that was a willingness to invite everyone present whenever it was time to eat a meal. Friends or enemies to all share in a simple meal during which divisions might begin to break down through a table fellowship in which everyone is invited to eat. From a broader perspective, as you heard during the spoken meditation, there's an interesting new book from Beacon Press that reflects the role of ritual in religious traditions, A History of Religion in 5.5 Objects, Bringing the Spiritual to Its Senses. The author, Brent Plate, reflects on the ways that often the simplest, most commonplace objects, stones, incense, drums, crosses, bread, we could name others, can become invested with tremendous, even transformative, pathos and meaning when they are paid attention to in a communal ritual way. The author claims, as Laura mentioned earlier, that half in the title, A History of Religion in 5.5 Objects, is symbolic of our incomplete natures, the need for a human body to be made whole through relations with something outside itself. And although I agree with that statement from the perspective of our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence, to be honest, my perception is that making the title A History of Religion in 5.5 Objects is mostly just a marketing ploy to pique your curiosity enough to open the book and say, what does he mean, 5.5 objects? It's like the spin behind that news announcer that throws to commercial with the line, up next, 3 common objects in your basement that could kill you and your family. You're meant to think, no, I need to know now. You know, I'll certainly sit through the commercials now. And just because it's an obvious manipulation doesn't mean it isn't effective. Just like it's not paranoid if they really are out to get you, right? I mean, like, it's just realistic. I find the book's subtitle more direct and persuasive, Bringing the Spiritual to Its Senses. That's what I find most important about ritual, introducing simple objects, stone, incense, drums, crosses, bread, in a way that can transform our worship and ourselves through taste, touch, smell, sight, and sound. These senses can transport and transform us. When I think of the long history of stones in the history of religion, what immediately comes to mind for me are the pyramids in Egypt. Have any of you visited Cairo? That was the first leg of a 6-week trip I took in the winter of 99 that went to Egypt and Jordan and Israel and Italy. And by far, it was, I mean, as amazing things as we saw in those 6 weeks, it was all downhill from the pyramids. I mean, it was truly breathtaking. If you can ever get to Cairo, do. Those pyramids in Egypt were astoundingly constructed, and those stones are huge. Go Google image that later and look at a human being standing in front of a single one of those stones that the pyramids are built out of. They were astoundingly constructed 4,000 years ago, or Stonehenge in England, built around the same time. Pretty big rocks as well. Or simply cairns that Laura mentioned, those stacks of rocks. You often see them, especially in Ireland and England, those simple but beautifully breathtaking stacks of rocks. Or the stones built into the Jerusalem temple, including those that remain as the Wailing Wall. Or the rock at the center of the Kaaba in Mecca that you see people circumambulating as part of the annual pilgrimage, the Hajj. But Plait's books also reminded me of the discovery in the 1960s that some of you may remember of those great stone rings of Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey, evidence of ritual gatherings, aesthetic creations, and the use of stone for religion more than 11,000 years ago. That's Neolithic religion, dating 6,000 years before Stonehenge, 7,000 years before the pyramids at Giza. It's the oldest known temple on Earth. I invite you to remember some of those deep, resonant connections through space and time between rocks and religion the next time you hold one of those stones in your hand for joys and sorrows or some related ritual. If you're particularly moved by your sense of smell, perhaps you would appreciate some of the meetings of our Earth-Centered Spirituality Group, as Laura mentioned earlier, who regularly incorporate incense, and as well as other spells, but particularly incense and sage into some of their rituals, third Sundays in the chapel at 10 a.m., or in evenings during the celebrations of the eight Sabbaths on the Wheel of the Year. Last night was summer solstice. Then you celebrate the winter solstice, the equinox, and then, of course, the cross quarter days. So you celebrate those 8 points of dividing the year into eight and making yourself more present. But often smell in particular is used as part of those rituals. And if you've never experienced the ritual walking of our outdoor labyrinth, it's not behind closed doors. It's right there. You can do it any time that feels meaning to you. You can walk out there and check it out later. So it's in the grass. It's, if any of you have never seen the pattern, it's what's called a unicursal pattern. There's one way in and one way out, so you can't get lost. There's no minotaur at the center of this labyrinth. And it's meant to be a walking meditation, so that as you walk in the traditional, there's other ways to do it, but the basic stance is the walking in is known as shedding. That you use that slow walk in through the 13th circuits to let go of what you need to let go to be fully present. And then in the center, to receive and open yourself to receiving what you need to let emerge in that time and space. And then on that slow walk back out, to integrate whatever you've experienced, and then so that you can bring that out into the world. And one of the things that, again, our UU Pagan or Earth-Centered group offers is a monthly full moon labyrinth walk. So every full moon, it's either out there, in here. And that can be a really meaningful ritual to commit to for a full year. That every full moon, I'm going to come here between 8 and 10 p.m. and to sort of pay attention to what you need to integrate and pay attention to over 12 months of the next year. That's a ritual I invite you to consider that's meaningful to many people here. And always at the first hour from 8 to 9 is silent, if that's what you prefer, or from 9 to 10 is drumming. So you're invited to bring hand drums or percussion instruments, or often there's some here. And that drum is Plait's third example of objects that have a deep history in religious ritual. We could spend a lot of time this morning talking about the ways when Christians came in, the drums often ended. So that's a imperialist problem. But that's another thing we're reclaiming, is learning that drums, percussion, I don't know if some of you were here, one of the last times the choir performed, we had a hand drum in there, and it came in about halfway through, and you could tell the song was immensely elevated and added this whole new depth dimension to it through percussion that was lost for many centuries in the Christian tradition. And as Laura mentioned as well, archetypally, one of the reasons we resonate with the drum is primordially, it reminds us of our heartbeat, the rhythmic pumping of our lifeblood. Plait's fourth religious ritual object is crosses, which Western civilization has come to associate most strongly, of course, with Christianity. But the Egyptian Ankh is one of many reminders, as is the Native American mandala, that the cross precedes Christianity and archetypally represents the intersection, the meeting of different parts, the four winds, or the vertical and the horizontal dimensions of life, the meeting of the sacred and the mundane. If you look at the cover of your order of service, you'll see our version here at UUCF of the classic Unitarian Universalist logo of a chalice surrounded by a circle. That circle represents the Universalist part of our heritage, that all-inclusive circle that we're going to draw a circle to bring you in, even if you're trying to shut us out. But also that chalice, if you pay attention, is intentionally cruciform. It's intentionally cross-shaped. It's even more obvious in the original UUA logo than it is in our logo. But also that cross, both here and in the UUA, is intentionally off-center to show that we have deep liberal Christian roots, but Christianity is now decentered to make room for the other five sources: science, earth-centered traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism. So that's also part of that symbol. Plate's final religious object is bread, which we've already talked about a little bit. And I invite you to consider, though, as we move toward the end of this service and toward lunch, I'm sorry if I'm reminding you of that and you're hungry, but I invite you to consider that that word companion, kom, pan, literally means with bread, panera, right? Pan, kom, so with bread. Companion is literally someone with whom you break bread, the one that you sit down to eat with. And I invite you to consider making it your practice that whenever, you may not literally break bread, but to have that first bite of food, to be both grateful for that, but also an invitation to be more fully present, a reminder to say, who is it that's my companion right now, the one with whom I'm breaking bread, and see that as an invitation to be more fully present to the one with whom you're eating. Each meal is another opportunity and an invitation to break down walls and build community with those with whom you find yourself. For now, I'll leave you with a final invitation. Sometime this afternoon or in the next week or so, I invite you to take a leisurely walk. Now, it's hot outside, so it can be as short as to the end of the block and back, the end of the driveway and back, whatever feels right to you. Allow that walk to be a symphony of the senses for you. Pay attention to all that you notice through your five senses. Perhaps you'll see on that walk a particular object that resonates with you. I went on a retreat years ago where a spiritual director invited me to do that. I thought she was crazy. She was like, go take a walk and find an object that resonates with you. I was like, what are you talking about? But it worked, actually. So I pass that on to you. You might be surprised with what you notice if you slow down and open your senses. Perhaps that object might be the start of a simple home altar in the corner of a room or at the corner of your desk that may cause you to pause periodically and remember the beauty and the wonder all around us, even or especially through such commonplace objects as stones, incense, drums, crosses, or bread. I'll end with this poem from Mary Oliver from her collection, Thirst. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot, or just a few small stones. Just pay attention, and then patch a few words together. And don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks, and a silence in which another voice may speak.